Hey there, thanks for coming. Take a seat.
Time to retire to the drawing room.
When C.S. Bacash published her book Captive Prince online, she wasn't expecting to eventually reach 15 million hits. Since then, her self-published fantasy books have become Amazon bestsellers and she's scored an international publishing deal. Not bad at all. She joins us in the drawing room along with independent publisher and artist Faye and Davey. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Catherine, I imagine it's been a bit of a whirlwind.
It's been an amazing 12 months.
Tell me more.
I started to serialise my book about 3 years ago, and in that time I saw the readership grow from literally 6 readers to tens of thousands of readers who turn up every time that I published a chapter. And when I self-published the books at the end of that time, within 24 hours they were hitting number one across Amazon lists. And there was so much word of mouth on blogs and places like Goodreads that the book started to pick up reviews from mainstream review sites. And 4 weeks later, I was approached by a New York agent, and she said to me, "I think we can sell your book to a big six publisher in New York." I signed with her only in the spirit of pure optimism, but we ended up getting 2 offers, and the most robust of which was from Penguin. And yeah, now the book's being published in multiple countries in multiple languages.
So within 12 months, you went from aspiring writer to a big thing.
Yeah, within 12 months, I went from a free online web serial to an international publishing deal.
Why did you decide to publish online? Had you approached publishers and been knocked back before? What motivated you?
When I started to write Captive Prince, I think there was nothing really like it in commercial bookshops. But I knew that there was a vast community of readers who were reading and writing online, in part because they were looking for something that they weren't finding necessarily in shops. I thought that, oh, this is something that I could do. This is something that I'm interested in. I think that community, especially because a lot of the fiction is free, it's been unwatched by commercial interests, and that's been very important for it artistically. When you think no one has their eye on you, or when you think no one is watching, the kind of creativity that goes on is quite remarkable, and everyone in that community really feels it. I think when there's a dollar sign attached or even the drive for publication, those pressures can change things. So this is a community that's been telling this for about 2 decades, the kind of stories that we haven't really let ourselves tell in public before, and that was a space that I felt was very dynamic and was really appealing to me.
Fayon, your publishing trajectory is really interesting. You used to have a successful career with the UN. What happened?
I was working in the UN until about 2005. At the time, I was directing a Centre of Education for Peace Building in Toronto in Canada, but it was an international centre. And I had just reached a point where I was burnt out, and I think mainly from the level of discussions. Like, I kept returning to the UN for meetings and seeing the same discussions over terminology, and I just thought there has to be kind of other ways to get outside this. All along, I had actually been maintaining like a private sort of hobby art practice as my way of thinking and reflecting on issues. And I realised that, you know, if I actually wanted to challenge my own thinking, then I needed to take a leap of faith and to leave what I was doing. And I came to Melbourne and enrolled as a mature student at the VCA.
How can art help us bring new ways of thinking to complex and also very stagnant problems? You just referred to it, the same conversations. How does art change that?
I mean, I don't know how it does for everybody, but for me, what I find and what I do with my art practice now is that my approach to drafting and editing a painting is very similar to the way that I draft and edit a text work. And so a lot of the exhibitions I've been making lately involve some sort of fictional text which I create, and alongside I produce a series of paintings. Those paintings, they seem abstract to other people, but to me they are actually kind of mirror images of the texts. So I'll work on either a text or a painting, and when I get stuck on one or the other, I'll move to its parallel. And I find in that way the paintings allow me to escape a kind of linguistic logic, a kind of rational logic. I can get into a space which is more ambiguous and has a different type of terrain, and that kind of frees my thinking to take more creative responses when I move back to a text.
I wonder if I can return to you, Catherine.
Mm-hmm.
I want to know more about this. You said that you feel like when you're writing online and you feel like no one's watching, all sorts of creative things emerge because you don't feel like you have to censor. It's sort of artistic bliss in some ways. Is that going to now change for you that you're having commercial success? Do you worry about that?
I do worry about that. I think having had that experience, I know that for myself, those are the kinds of energies that I really want to keep alive in my creative practice. I think that the online space that we discussed is actually right now on the cusp of commercialization. We've seen a couple of works emerge from that space. In a sense, they've been beta testing for 2 decades what the wider community right now is on the verge of monetizing. I do think, yeah, that commercialization will actively change that space when it happens, but I guess it's an inevitable process when it comes to any new artistic discipline. There's always that initial burst that is often free form, that is often not commercialized, and then commercial interests kind of step in at a certain point.
And for me, I've actually had a situation where I initially thought that the logical thing to do after setting up an independent publishing project in relation to art books was to get a distributor. And I did have a distributor for the last couple of years, but I've actually chosen to terminate that relationship and to step back because I found that it was imposing too many restrictions on the freedom for us to let the books do what we hope to do in terms of prompting conversation.
So where will self publishers go when the online space is commercialised?
Yeah, there's always going to be underground artistic movements of one kind or another. I guess the elephant in the room when it comes to self-publishing is that there's still somewhat of a stigma attached to it. Publishing is not like the music industry where the more independently you do something, the cooler you are. We have a different relationship towards text where we think of it as having authority, and in some ways we want to feel like it's passed through a gate, it's been anointed by a publisher, this is really a book. Sometimes when
that's
books,
very true, isn't
yeah.
it? It's almost like the extra layer of legitimization isn't there.
I was going to come at it another way, in that part of this sort of decommercialization for me comes about through an extra valuing of bookstores as places of engagement. I had a great experience with a bookstore in Glasgow where I had a 3-month residency and really activated the books through a range of performances, poetry, sound works. And I've recently been invited to the 3rd Ural Industrial Biennale in Russia to do the same with their Biennale bookstore. The problem was before with a distributor, with those sort of, once it's put into like strictly commercial terms, then you don't have the freedom to sometimes sort of move around in that artistic space. For me, it's a different set of issues in the art community. It's not to say that we're not still selling the books, but I think I'm sort of placing my efforts elsewhere in terms of really focusing in on the content of the books and how you get people conversing around those and create communities of readers and thinkers around them.
Starting the actual conversations. You're in the drawing room up on RN Drive, and with me is Fayenda Evie. She's an artist and a publisher, and C.S. Pakash, author of the Captive Prince Fantasy Trilogy. And I want to go to the Captive Prince fantasy trilogy.
Let's go there.
Why has it garnered such a huge following?
You know, I would love to think it's because I wrote a cracking book, but
oh,
I think
it's got to be part of the reason, surely.
I mean, there's other factors in play as well. I think that to some extent it's because it is new. It does share something of those dynamic energies that we were talking about before. It comes from a community that's used to dealing with very, very intense, escapist, addictive storytelling, dealing with subject matter that can feel quite fresh that we don't necessarily see in the commercially published landscape.
Which is?
In the case of Captive Prince, it's quite a homoerotic text and it deals with a very intense relationship between the two male main characters. There's themes of very intense sexuality. It has some quite extreme settings at times. I think the fantasy genre is very, very good at dealing with extremes of human behaviour. I think I do owe a lot to the online community that the book was born out of.
But the online community responds differently to the myriad of stuff that's out there. I mean, you know, there's not really a shortage on the internet. You're still in huge competition with so many others. It's not as if it's, you know, the red carpet's out for you.
You are definitely in competition with the entire rest of the internet. But I guess I was lucky enough to have a story that really spoke to people. My book did run in serial format, which is a really powerful format in terms of generating word of mouth. You know, we've all seen suddenly around episode 6, everyone's talking about the Serial podcast. Suddenly, midway through season 2, everyone's talking about Game of Thrones.
But which brings me to ask, of course, where to now? I mean, TV series Game of Thrones style, now that you've raised it.
I mean, if HBO calls, I'll definitely answer the phone.
We'll put that out. We'll tweet that out. HBO, get calling. Now, Fayon, we've talked about the online world, but you, as we've said, you're still engaging with paper. And I'm a big lover of paper. And it seems that art books are one of the few genres that are still actually selling in hard copy sense. Is that right?
I think that there are lots of interesting online examples of people engaging with digital literature. But for me, I'm really interested in the book and the book form. And in fact, one of the books was initially an approach from an American academic who works in digital media, who asked me if I would move into some sort of e-book. But the more that we talked about it, I felt like I just couldn't grab onto what was interesting about that. So what we ended up doing was turning an artist, Christopher Algie Hill's Twitter poetry project, into a printed matter book form. And so I still feel like there's a translation there between the digital and the print, but it ended up resulting in print. And I think for artists, there's something special about a printed book versus the kind of flattening that happens on a screen or on the internet.
I think the tactile experience of an art book is really appealing as well, to have it in the house as a thing to engage with.
Sure. And as you say, I mean, you have art books around your house, and I started out in the same way because, in fact, before 3ply became some sort of formalised publishing entity, I was sitting at home reading these art books, and I was a major fan of an artist, Matt Hinckley's practice, and so I approached Matt at that time to see if he would be interested in making a book. And the way that he approached it in terms of this sort of concertina strategy that opens and can unfold and refold and creates this endless variation of collages that, to anyone who knows his work, really, you know, is like his work, but is affordable. You know, you can actually have a piece of this within your personal library and return to it again and again.
That's interesting. I do find with a physical book that I can achieve a level of immersion and concentration that I can't necessarily with the screen, where I'm always anticipating interruption or I'm aware of the fact that my screen can be used for other things in the back of my mind. But at the same time, I found it interesting what you were saying, because a lot of writers now write straight into a computer. So they're writing in digital form, and that is, in a weird sense, almost a more honest expression of their work. And the book itself, in some ways, is artificial for words that have never really been on paper until the moment that the book is printed.
And yet for a lot of the artists that I work with, they may never have engaged with a book. They may not make text works generally within their practice. And so those questions of materiality do become part of that expression of their self and their practice, like paying attention to the type of the stock or whether an image has a matte varnish or a gloss varnish is a really natural process for artists.
Catherine, is there something really wrong with the commercial world in that you were saying that your books were quite fringe or underground and you're dealing with themes that are not dealt with often in the commercial world,
yeah.
Obviously fantasy, gay and lesbian culture and themes. But given you've had so much commercial success,
yeah,
there's clearly a very commercial road for this kind of stuff. What is wrong with the people in charge, the gatekeepers, that it takes them kind of a bit of a while to see this?
Oh, I'm not sure that there's something wrong necessarily. I think it's probably two things, the first of which is that when something is new, its marketing potential is zero, or at best, question mark. It represents a risk to, you know, a venture capitalist, which is, in a sense, what a publisher is. But I think, on the other hand, literature, you know, like all forms of artistic endeavour, is a forward-moving enterprise. So you build on what's come before. Like, all of human endeavour works in that way. If there's nothing to build on, when you look at the world of commercially published books and you don't find a literary antecedent for your work, you can't simply create that work out of nowhere. You have to sort of look at, in my case, look online, where people were starting to write these kinds of stories. That space for me, that's where that kernel of possibility, that seed, like something like Captive Prince could be a book, came from. Yeah, I think it's those two things. First of all, what's new represents risk. And secondly, we haven't necessarily seen a tradition of this kind of work in the commercial space before now.
Thank you to both of you, Catherine and Fayyan, for coming into the drawing room and having this really fascinating conversation.
Oh, thank you very
much.
Thanks
for having us.
And that's Catherine, or better known as C.S. Pacat. She's the author of the Captive Prince Fantasy Trilogy, and Fayyan Deevi, who is an artist and a publisher. And Captain Prince is out now through Penguin and still available online as well.
You can purchase the e-books online, but it's no longer available as a free work online.
Look at you. You're charging.
It's the
quick
and the dead,
for
Patricia.
Your labour. It's about time you charge for your labour. I'm all for it. And Fayyan, where can people find out more about your publications?
Well, one of the ways they can is through the Melbourne Art Book Fair, which is happening on the 2nd and 3rd of May. It's a free event on those days. So I'd really encourage people to come down and they can view some of the books there.
And that's if they're in Melbourne. Thank you to both of you so much.